as quickly as you can.
Hey, brothers, pour the wine.
Pour it quickly once again.
Hey, brothers, pour the wine.
She's here at last, my one and only. Goodbye, friends, and don't be lonely when you see the way she walks. Hey, brother, pour the wine.
Arizona's known for its five C's of industry: copper, cattle, citrus, climate, and cotton. Wine kind of predates all those, though. We've got a wine historian joining us in the studio right now, Mr. Eric Berg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And how far back does wine date in Arizona?
Well, you know, that was when I first got interested in the subject. That is one of the things I was interested in finding out. If you look around, you'll see a lot of references to wine in Arizona going back 450 years to the 16th century with Jesuits planting, you know, vines at the missions to make wine for the celebration of Mass. And that is, you know, a pretty broad, widely repeated story here in Arizona. But, you know, if you know your Spanish colonial history, although there are Spanish groups moving through Arizona at that time, it takes about 2 years to plant a vineyard, you know, and bring it to fruition and start producing fruit. And there's really no Spanish settlers, missionaries, or anything else that are here that long in the 16th century. So there definitely was not any wine production then. But I got interested in when did it start? And I spent a lot of time researching and going through archives and reading translated materials from the Spanish colonial period, looking at archaeological reports. And after years of research on this, I can definitively tell you that when it comes to when the first wine was produced in Arizona, nobody really knows.
Definitively.
Yes.
Definitively.
Now, we can come up with some pretty good ideas. We know that Kino, the famous Jesuit missionary that explored a lot of Arizona, he established a mission in Dolores back in the late 1600s, 1687, and that's south of the border in northern Sonora. And he did plant vines there and make a little bit of wine. He probably did not. None of his missionaries at that time probably really planted any vines in Arizona. They didn't really get the missions going until later. And if you look at Spanish colonial records from the late 1700s, which is really the peak of Spanish period here in Arizona, most of the references is to how rare wine is. And one of the reasons is because a lot of the Spanish sites were in the Santa Cruz River Valley, where it's very hot and humid, and the grapes would often rot before they could produce wine. But there probably was a little bit of wine making done in Arizona, probably in the very late 1700s, early 1800s, but probably not as much as people think.
Rain burden ewing hadn't been established yet at that point.
Yes.
The water was kind of an issue.
Yes. Yeah, water was an issue, and just too much heat and humidity. Even today, the Spanish colonial sites are not in good wine grape growing places. But it is worth noting that just a little bit to the east in New Mexico, missionaries did start vineyards in kind of southern New Mexico around El Paso. Local settlers would take cuttings of the vines from the missions. They would start their own vineyards for commercial purposes. And by the early 1700s, there was an estimated 250,000 vines along the Rio Grande from El Paso up to near present-day Las Cruces. So, it was one of the largest wine-producing regions in North America, certainly the largest in what is today the United States. So you could certainly say that the American wine industry really got started in the Southwest. There's not a lot of wood, you know, in the Southwest to make barrels and vats. So in along the Rio Grande, they would actually, many times back then, they would take a big cowhide, you know, make a giant, you know, vat out of a cowhide, and they would actually crush the grapes and ferment it in the cowhide instead of a barrel.
Yum.
Yes. Now, if you've been to a wine tasting—
Is that Menudo?
Yes. Yeah. You probably want a little Menudo after that. Yes.
You need a bunch of that wine.
Oh, my goodness.
But, you know, if you've been to a wine tasting, you know people like to have all these descriptive things. It tastes like raspberries and tobacco and stuff like this. And you often hear about a wine having notes of leather. Well, El Paso wine, you know, they definitely had notes of leather.
Oh, no.
Yummy.
That's a revelation to me for a wine drinker.
Yes.
Oh. So not to distract from wine, but you know how cheese was discovered? So you need rennet, which is a product found inside the stomach of an animal. And the people in the Sahara Desert would put milk inside the stomach of animals that they had harvested for eating. Well, that was their canteen, was the stomach
right.
of these animals. And after sloshing around in the stomach, and they'd go to eat the drink their milk, and it had all these curds in it, they discovered that's how cheese was discovered.
The original meat and cheese plate.
Yes.
And I guess you could say that steak and wine go together because of that, too.
Yeah, yes, yeah, exactly.
They were a much heartier bunch back then.
Yes, they were. Yeah, you know, you find a hair in your wine, and it could have come from the processing, so. But some of the wine was probably actually pretty good from what, you know, the reports that came across.
Well, I guess if you didn't have anything else, you know, to compare it to.
Yes, exactly. You know, as opposed to well water, it's not that hard of a choice.
Now, it kind of went dead for a long time, and then it seems like about 30 years ago, they got a wild hare down around Sonoyta, Elgin, and they said, well, let's try it again. And, I mean, it's a significant industry down there in Cochise County.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there was actually a lot of winemaking in the territorial period, too, you know, the Wild West days. And you know, we can talk about that a little bit, too. But, yeah, in really, you know, the current modern wine industry started about 1979, 1980. That's when the first vineyard and winery started. And it kind of, you know, struggled along there for a while. But in the last 10, 15, 20 years, it has boomed.
Oh, man.
Yes, Sonoyta, Wilcox, and the Verde Valley, too, is the other big
well,
location.
Staying on the time frame, let's jump back to that territorial time.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot with the Spanish missions. Now, you mentioned there was, but it was more coastal, Los Angeles. We don't think of L.A. as a big wine area. You think of
right.
Northern California or you know, starting at Paso Robles North,
mm-hmm.
turns into wine country. But L.A. at the time was the big wine producer.
Yeah, if you'd been back in the Los Angeles Valley, you know, back in the early 1800s, you know, there weren't as many skyscrapers as there are now, obviously. and there was a mission there, San Gabriel Mission. And, you know, it's mostly at that time a mission and a few little settlers in that area. It's very rural. And San Gabriel Mission was one of the big wine producers on the Spanish colonial frontier. It made not just wine for itself, but for the other missions. It had about, in the early 1800s, about 180 acres of vineyards for wine. And this was not just for the use of the church. It was also for sale to raise funds. And same thing as in El Paso, local settlers, they'd take cuttings from the vineyards, San Gabriel and other places. They'd start their own vineyards for commercial purposes. And that's really how the California wine industry got started. And by, you know, the time of the Civil War, it was already one of our country's biggest wine producers.
And a lot of that got shipped into Arizona,
mm-hmm.
leather hide and all.
Yes. Well, now this time they're probably using barrels, although they're also almost certainly using hides as well. But yeah, you know, we're so close, relatively speaking, it still took a long time. But once the trains came in, it was easier. And so, yeah, in the, you know, the Wild West days of Arizona, you know, we watch the movies and the cowboys and the gunfighters, they go into saloon and they want beer and whiskey. You know, you've got the famous Whiskey Row up in Prescott. And those were certainly popular drinks. But what I think people have forgotten today is that wine was also very popular on the Western frontier. And in fact, if you look at saloon ads in newspapers from the 1870s, 80s, that period, they're talking about, you know, wine. That's really what they're promoting. That's really what sets them apart from other places. So, you know, Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday, they might have had a nice glass of wine after the shootout at the OK Corral.
I've never seen a John Wayne movie where someone walks into a saloon and asks, may I see your wine list?
Yes, exactly. Bartender, this Chardonnay is too oaky. Yeah, that's shooting words.
Yeah.
It's not, we forgot it today, but it was a very popular drink. Some saloons even specialized in wine. And part of the reason for this is that a lot of the people that came west in this period, the late 19th century, they're immigrants, first or second generation sometimes, coming from many of the European countries where wine is a very important part of the culture. So it's not just having a fun time in a saloon. It's also just having a bottle of table wine at home with dinner. So wine was a really important part of the culture for a lot of these early immigrants. And they started to try to make some wine in Arizona back in that period. But most of the wine that was drank in Arizona probably did come in from California. There was also some winemaking in Missouri and New York, the Finger Lakes. Some of that would come over. And sometimes you would have even French wine. More often than not, there was another type of French wine, which was California wine with French labels, you know, kind of a hybrid wine, if you will. But a lot of the wine in Arizona did come from California, and particularly the Los Angeles Valley, and particularly the Rancho Cucamonga. There's a really great book, Vanished Arizona, written by Martha Summerhays. She was an Army officer's wife in Arizona back in the 1870s, and she makes multiple references to Cucamonga wine. So you get the impression the only way she survived an Arizona summer was with Cucamonga wine from California. And, you know, it's now that it's getting heat, you know, we're getting close to 100 again. This is a good time to start drinking.
Get out. What do you think she had for the pool? Was the Salt River running full time then?
Yes, yeah. The Colorado, a little dip in the muddy Colorado and a nice glass of Cucamonga. You know, that's a perfect afternoon in Arizona in the 1870s.
So then the Prohibition hits and pretty much kills what little wine industry growing Arizona had.
Yeah, the you know, in Arizona, so they really started first trying to make wine in the Salt River Valley. You've got farmers in there from the 1860s onward, and they're mostly planting food crops, but they almost always planted grapes and orchards. Most of the grapes in the Salt River Valley were table or raisin grapes, which, you know, is a different type of grape, and it actually became a big grape producer. But some of them naturally said, hey, we can grow table grapes here. Let's do wine grapes. You know, you can make more money off of wine, and everybody likes wine. And so they started experimenting with wine in really the early 1870s. But to be honest, they weren't very good at it. The Salt River Valley is not the best place for wine grapes. The end result was often something that was not real good, and they would often doctor it with sugar. So the Arizona wine tended to be a bit sweet and a bit high in alcohol. And in 1885, some of these Arizona winemakers, and they're usually farmers doing this on the side, they send a sample of their wine to a California wine merchant, hoping that the wine merchant will pick it up and distribute it around the West. And the wine merchant rejects the Arizona wine and says it's too sweet and it's too high in alcohol. Well, the Phoenix Gazette newspaper heard about this, and it writes a little article standing up for the Arizona wine. And in the article, it says, well, we Arizonans, we like our wine a bit sweet. And furthermore, it is impossible to put too much alcohol in one bottle to displease the average Arizona drinker. So there, California. But yes, going back to, you know, Prohibition in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you've got this Prohibition movement across the United States. Much of it is aimed at beer and whiskey, but certainly wine as well. And it didn't help that a lot of the wineries in Arizona in the late 1800s, you know, were kind of not really great product and were associated with public drunkenness. And in 1897, there was one winery in Mesa, the Jones Winery, that had a particularly bad reputation. And in 1897, there was this big fight where a bunch of homeless men got in a brawl with some local people and one person was killed just outside the winery. And the next day, the Arizona Republican newspaper blamed it on Jones's beverage, and they described his wine as, quote, a homicidal wine, one which has the tendency to make one lapse into forgetfulness of his duties to society, the church, and state. So I've heard something to decide as a killer wine, but a homicidal wine, that did not help their cause.
Now, Eric, I just got to ask, like, do you make a living researching the history of wine? Is this your vocation or is this a hobby?
You know, I'm actually this is more of a hobby. I'm a software engineer for Intel.
Okay.
But you know, when you've just been writing code for 60 hours a week and just fighting some big bug, you know, a glass of wine is just sort of a natural partner to that.
And you've published.
Yes. This research. I used to be a wine drinker, but a beer drinker. But my girlfriend is very much into wine, so we started going to wineries, and I got interested in the history. I've been researching and writing and talking about Arizona history for the last 20 years. Was president of the Grand Canyon Historical Society for a while.
Well, we gotta have this guy back. Oh man!
But my research. I spent a couple years researching this and did an article for the Journal of Arizona History back in the fall of 2018, and also wrote a history section for a great book that's out on Arizona wine by my friend, the photographer Janelle Bonifield. It's called Arizona Uncorked, and it's just beautiful pictures of the vineyards and the wineries and the winemakers and stories about all of them. And I did some of the writing for that as well.
Well, very good. We've got one more segment right after this.